Martin Luther King, in Word and Stone. It is one of the enduring mysteries of American history, so near providential as to give the most hardened atheist pause, that it should have produced at every hinge point great men who matched the moment. A roiling revolutionary 18th century British colony gives birth to the greatest cohort of political thinkers ever: Jefferson, Adams, Madison, Hamilton, Washington, Franklin, Jay. The crisis of the 19th century brings forth Lincoln. The 20th, FDR. Equally miraculous is Martin Luther King Jr., Black America's righteous revolt against a century of post-emancipation oppression could have gone in many bitter and destructive directions. It did not. This was largely the work of one man's leadership, moral imagination, and strategic genius. He turned his own deeply Christian belief that unearned suffering is redemptive into a creed of nonviolence that he carved into America's political consciousness. The result was not just racial liberation, but national redemption. Such an achievement, such a life, deserves a monument alongside the other miracles of our history, Lincoln, Jefferson, and FDR, which is precisely where stands the new Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial. It opened Monday on the Tidal Basin, adjacent to Roosevelt's 7 acres, directly across from Jefferson's temple, and bisecting the invisible cartographic line connecting the memorials for Jefferson and Lincoln, authors of America's first two births of freedom, whose promises awaited fulfillment by King. The new King Memorial has its flaws, most notably its much-debated central element, the massive 30-foot stone carving of a standing, arms-crossed, somewhat stern king. The criticism has centered on origins. The statue was made in China by a Chinese artist. The problem, however, is not ethnicity, but sensibility. Lei Yixin, who receives a lifetime government stipend, has created 150 public monuments in the People's Republic, including several of Chairman Mao. It shows. His flat, rigid, socialist, realist king does not do justice to the supremely nuanced, creative, humane soul of its subject. The artistic deficiencies, however, are trumped by placement. You enter the memorial through a narrow passageway, emerging onto a breathtaking opening to the Tidal Basin, a tranquil, tree-lined oasis with Jefferson at the far shore. Here stands King, gazing across to the promised land, promised by that very same Jefferson, but whose shores King himself was never to reach. You are standing at America's Mount Nebo. You cannot but be deeply moved. Behind the prophet, guarding him, is an arc of short quotations chiseled in granite. This is in keeping with that glorious feature of Washington's monumental core, the homage to words rather than images of conquest and glory, as in so many other capitals, as befits a nation founded on an idea. The choice of King quotations is not without problems, however. There are 14 quotes, but in no discernible order, chronological or thematic. None are taken from the I Have a Dream speech for understandable reasons of pedagogical redundancy. Nevertheless, some of the quotes are simply undistinguished, capturing none of the cadence and poetry of King's considerable canon. More troubling, however, is the philosophical narrowness. The citations dwell almost exclusively on the universalist element of King's thought. Exhortations, for example, that our loyalties must transcend our race, our tribe, our class, and our nation, and this means we must develop a world perspective, and every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. Transcending all forms of sectarianism to achieve a common humanity was, of course, a major element of King's thought, but it was not the only one. Missing is any sense of King's Americanness. Indeed, the word America appears only once, and only in the context of stating his opposition to the Vietnam War. Yet, as King himself insisted, his dream was deeply rooted in the American dream. He consciously rooted civil rights in the American story, not just for tactical reasons of enlisting whites in the struggle, but because he deeply believed that his movement, while fiercely adversarial, was quintessentially American, indeed a profound vindication of the American creed. And yet, however much one wishes for a more balanced representation of King's own creed, there is no denying the power of this memorial. You must experience it. In the heart of the nation's capital, King now literally takes his place in the American pantheon, the only non-president to be so honored. As of August 22, 2011, there is no room for anyone more on the shores of the tidal basin. This is as it should be. The Washington Post, August 25, 2011. Collective guilt, collective responsibility. No matter where you stand in the debate over the German cemetery at Bitburg, should President Reagan visit or should he not, everyone from Chancellor Helmut Kohl to Elie Wiesel seems to agree that there is, or ought to be, no such thing as collective responsibility. As Wiesel said in his White House address, "I do not believe in collective guilt, nor in collective responsibility. Only the killers are guilty." Can that be true? To start with, it is not the view of the common law. If you rob a bank and shoot the teller, you are not the only person guilty of murder. So is your unarmed accomplice and the driver of the getaway car. In short, anyone who knowingly joined the criminal enterprise. The law spreads wide the net of guilt in order to express a moral truth. When you join a killing enterprise, your private moral scruples do not limit your guilt. You may not be a killer, but if you sign up with killers, you are party to the deed. In fact, Wiesel's own argument against the Bitburg visit rests correctly on the idea of collective guilt. Wiesel implored the president not to go because of the presence of SS graves. He did not inquire into the individual deeds of these SS men. He did not need to. To be a member of the SS is enough. Did any of these men pull the trigger at Malmedy, where the Waffen SS murdered 71 American POWs? Or at Oradour, where they murdered 642 Frenchmen? Or was it their comrades? It hardly matters. These crimes would simply compound the guilt. To be a member of the SS is guilt enough. When you join the most monstrous of killing organizations, when you carry its seal, you become responsible for its crimes. The collective guilt of the German army is of a different order. The SS was designed to kill, the Wehrmacht to defend the killers and conquer at their command. This does not make the ordinary German soldier a mass murderer, but that said, he does not become the moral equivalent of, say, an American soldier. Between mass murder and ordinary soldierhood lies a vast moral no man's land, and in that no man's land lies Bitburg. Soldiers who die defending a regime of incomprehensible criminality are not criminals, but they bear, let us be charitable, a taint. Which is why even without the SS, Bitburg's dead are far down any list of those deserving to be graced by the presence of an American president. A soldier cannot totally divorce himself from his cause. When Lord Mountbatten died, he left instructions that the Japanese not be invited to his funeral. He could not forgive the way they had treated his men as prisoners in Southeast Asia during the war. Now, certainly only those Japanese who tortured his men were torturers, but just as certainly, the nation that produced these torturers and produced the war in which the tortures took place bears some taint. Not enough, by any means, to warrant a trial, but enough, certainly, to warrant exclusion from a funeral. We apply the same logic of collective guilt and measured response to white South Africans. Why, after all, are they banned from civilized international life, such as sports, if not for the feeling that by acquiescing to apartheid, they bear some guilt, for which ostracism is not too disproportionate a penalty? But what about those with no conceivable connection to a historical crime? Two-thirds of Germans today, Helmut Kohl likes to remind us, are too young to remember the war. Surely they do not bear collective responsibility for Germany's past? Surely they do. They bear, of course, no guilt, but they bear responsibility. The distinction is important. Ask yourself, none of us was around when treaties were made and broken with the Indians 100 years ago. We bear no guilt. Are we absolved of responsibility to make redress today for the sins of our fathers? I wasn't born when Japanese Americans were interned during World War II. If Congress decides to apologize or to compensate the victims with my tax dollars, Senator Spark Matsunaga introduced the resolution yesterday, will I have suffered an injustice? I think not. The point is this. There is such a thing as a corporate identity. My American identity entitles me to certain corporate privileges. Life, liberty, happiness pursued, columns uncensored. These benefits I receive wholly undeserved. They are mine by accident of birth. So are America's debts. I cannot claim one and disdain the other. During the centuries of slavery in America, my ancestors were being chased by unfriendly authorities across Eastern Europe. I feel, and bear, no guilt for the plight of blacks. But America's life is longer than mine. America has sins and obligations that flow from those sins. To be American today is to share in those obligations. Or are my children going to default on treasury bonds issued today on the grounds that they were not yet born when these collective obligations were incurred? It is good politics around VE Day to deny the notion of collective responsibility. Only, it is nonsense. Collective responsibility is an elementary principle of national life. It is not just that without that principle there would be no national apologies, such as that proposed by Manzunaga, or war reparations, such as those given by Democratic Germany to Nazi Germany's victims. There would be no bond market. The Washington Post, May 3, 1985. Part 3. Historical. Chapter 12. The Jewish Question, Again. Those Troublesome Jews. The world is outraged at Israel's blockade of Gaza. Turkey denounces its illegality, inhumanity, barbarity, etc. The usual UN suspects, Third World and European, join in. The Obama administration dithers. But as Leslie Gelb, former president of the Council on Foreign Relations, writes, the blockade is not just perfectly rational, it is perfectly legal. Gaza under Hamas is a self-declared enemy of Israel, a declaration backed up by more than 4,000 rockets fired at Israeli civilian territory. Yet having pledged itself to unceasing belligerency, Hamas claims victimhood when Israel imposes a blockade to prevent Hamas from arming itself with still more rockets. In World War II, with full international legality, the United States blockaded Germany and Japan. And during the October 1962 missile crisis, we blockaded, quarantined, Cuba. Arms-bearing Russian ships headed to Cuba turned back because the Soviets knew that the U.S. Navy would either board them or sink them. Yet Israel is accused of international criminality for doing precisely what John Kennedy did, impose a naval blockade to prevent a hostile state from acquiring lethal weaponry. Oh, but weren't the Gaza-bound ships on a mission of humanitarian relief? No. Otherwise, they would have accepted Israel's offer to bring their supplies to an Israeli port, be inspected for military materiel, and have the rest trucked by Israel into Gaza, as every week 10,000 tons of food, medicine, and other humanitarian supplies are sent by Israel to Gaza. Why was the offer refused? Because, as organizer Greta Berlin admitted, the flotilla was not about humanitarian relief, but about breaking the blockade, that is, ending Israel's inspection regime, which would mean unlimited shipping into Gaza and thus the unlimited arming of Hamas. Israel has already twice intercepted ships laden with Iranian arms destined for Hezbollah and Gaza. What country would allow that? But even more important, why did Israel even have to resort to blockade? Because blockade is Israel's fallback, as the world systematically delegitimizes its traditional ways of defending itself, forward and active defense. 1. Forward defense. As a small, densely populated country surrounded by hostile states, Israel had, for its first half century, adopted forward defense, fighting wars on enemy territory, such as the Sinai and Golan Heights, rather than its own. Where possible, Sinai, for example, Israel has traded territory for peace. But where peace offers were refused, Israel retained the territory as a protective buffer zone. Thus, Israel retained a small strip of southern Lebanon to protect the villages of northern Israel. And it took many losses in Gaza rather than expose Israeli border towns to Palestinian terror attacks. It is for the same reason America wages a grinding war in Afghanistan. You fight them there, so you don't have to fight them here. But under overwhelming outside pressure, Israel gave it up. The Israelis were told the occupations were not just illegal, but at the root of the anti-Israel insurgencies, and therefore withdrawal by removing the cause would bring peace. Land for peace, remember? Well, during the past decade, Israel gave the land, evacuating South Lebanon in 2000 and Gaza in 2005. What did it get? An intensification of belligerency, heavy militarization of the enemy side, multiple kidnappings, cross-border attacks, and from Gaza, years of unrelenting rocket attack. 2. Active defense. Israel then had to switch to active defense, military action to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat, to borrow President Obama's description of our campaign against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. The newly armed terrorist mini-states established in southern Lebanon and Gaza after Israel withdrew. The result? The Lebanon War of 2006 and Gaza Operation of 2008 and 9. They were met with yet another avalanche of opprobrium and calumny by the same international community that had demanded the Land for Peace Israeli withdrawals in the first place. Worse, the UN Goldstone Report, which essentially criminalized Israel's defensive operation in Gaza while whitewashing the casus belli, the preceding and unprovoked Hamas rocket war, effectively delegitimized any active Israeli defense against its self-declared terror enemies. 3. Passive defense. Without forward or active defense, Israel is left with but the most passive and benign of all defenses, a blockade to simply prevent enemy rearmament. Yet as we speak, this too is headed for international delegitimation. Even the United States is now moving toward having it abolished. But if none of these is permissible, what's left? Ah, but that's the point. It's the point understood by the blockade-busting flotilla of useful idiots and terror sympathizers, by the Turkish front organization that funded it, by the automatic anti-Israel Third World chorus at the United Nations, and by the supine Europeans who've had quite enough of the Jewish problem. What's left? Nothing. The whole point of this relentless international campaign is to deprive Israel of any legitimate form of self-defense. Why, just last week, the Obama administration joined the jackals and reversed four decades of U.S. practice by signing on to a consensus document that singles out Israel's possession of nuclear weapons, thus delegitimizing Israel's very last line of defense, deterrence. The world is tired of these troublesome Jews, 6 million hard by the Mediterranean, refusing every invitation to national suicide, for which they are relentlessly demonized, ghettoized, and constrained from defending themselves, even as the more committed anti-Zionists, Iranian in particular, openly prepare a more final solution. The Washington Post, June 4, 2010. Land without peace. While diplomatically inconvenient for the Western powers, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas's attempt to get the United Nations to unilaterally declare a Palestinian state has elicited widespread sympathy. After all, what choice did he have? According to the accepted narrative, Middle East peace is made impossible by a hardline Likud-led Israel that refuses to accept a Palestinian state and continues to build settlements. It is remarkable how this gross inversion of the truth has become conventional wisdom. In fact, Benjamin Netanyahu brought his Likud-led coalition to open recognition of a Palestinian state, thereby creating Israel's first national consensus for a two-state solution. He is also the only prime minister to agree to a settlement freeze, 10 months, something no Labor or Kadima government has ever done, to which Abbas responded by boycotting the talks for 9 months, showing up in the 10th, then walking out when the freeze expired. Last week, he reiterated that he will continue to boycott peace talks unless Israel gives up in advance claim to any territory beyond the 1967 lines, meaning, for example, that the Jewish quarter in Jerusalem is Palestinian territory. This is not just absurd, it violates every prior peace agreement. They all stipulate that such demands are to be the subject of negotiations, not their precondition. Abbas unwaveringly insists on the so-called right of return, which would demographically destroy Israel by swamping it with millions of Arabs, thereby turning the world's only Jewish state into the world's 23rd Arab state. And he has repeatedly declared, as recently as last week in New York, "We shall not recognize a Jewish state." Nor is this new. It is perfectly consistent with the long history of Palestinian rejectionism. Consider Camp David, 2000. At a U.S.-sponsored summit, Prime Minister Ehud Barak offers Yasser Arafat a Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza. And, astonishingly, the previously inconceivable division of Jerusalem. Arafat refuses and makes no counteroffer, thereby demonstrating his unseriousness about making any deal. Instead, within 2 months, he launches a savage terror war that kills 1,000 Israelis. Taba, 2001, an even sweeter deal, the Clinton parameters, is offered. Arafat walks away again. Israel, 2008, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert makes the ultimate capitulation to Palestinian demands, 100% of the West Bank with land swaps. Palestinian statehood, the division of Jerusalem with the Muslim parts becoming the capital of the new Palestine. And incredibly, he offers to turn over the city's holy places, including the Western Wall, Judaism's most sacred site, its Kaaba, to an international body on which sit Jordan and Saudi Arabia. Did Abbas accept? Of course not. If he had, the conflict would be over and Palestine would already be a member of the United Nations. This is not ancient history. All three peace talks occurred over the past decade. And everyone completely contradicts the current mindless narrative of Israeli intransigence as the obstacle to peace. Settlements? Every settlement remaining within the new Palestine would be destroyed and emptied, precisely as happened in Gaza. So why did the Palestinians say no? Because saying yes would have required them to sign a final peace agreement that accepted a Jewish state on what they consider the Muslim patrimony. The key word here is final. The Palestinians are quite prepared to sign interim agreements like Oslo, framework agreements like Annapolis, ceasefires like the 1949 armistice. Anything but a final deal. Anything but a final peace. Anything but a treaty that ends the conflict once and for all while leaving a Jewish state still standing. After all, why did Abbas go to the United Nations last week? For nearly half a century, the United States has pursued a Middle East settlement on the basis of the formula of land for peace. Land for peace produced the Israel-Egypt peace of 1979 and the Israel-Jordan peace of 1994. Israel has offered the Palestinians land for peace 3 times since and been refused every time. Why? For exactly the same reason Abbas went to the United Nations last week, to get land without peace. Sovereignty with no reciprocal recognition of a Jewish state. Statehood without negotiations. An independent Palestine in a continued state of war with Israel. Israel gave up land without peace in South Lebanon in 2000 and in return received war. The Lebanon War of 2006 and 50,000 Hezbollah missiles now targeted on the Israeli homeland. In 2005, Israel gave up land without peace in Gaza and again was rewarded with war and constant rocket attack from an openly genocidal Palestinian mini-state. Israel is prepared to give up land, but never again without peace, a final peace, which is exactly what every Palestinian leader, from Haj Amin al-Husseini to Yasser Arafat to Mahmoud Abbas, has refused to accept. Which is why, regardless of who is governing Israel, there has never been peace. Territorial disputes are solvable. Existential conflicts are not. Land for peace, yes. Land without peace is nothing but an invitation to national suicide. The Washington Post, September 29, 2011. Borat the Fearful. Borat is many things, a side-splitting triumph of slapstick and scatology, a runaway moneymaker and budding franchise. The worst thing to happen to Kazakhstan since the Mongol hordes and, as columnist David Brooks astutely points out, a supreme display of elite snobbery reveling in the humiliation of the hoaxed hillbilly. But it is one more thing, something Brooks alluded to in passing, but that requires at least one elaboration, an unintentionally revealing demonstration of the unfortunate attitude many liberal Jews have toward working-class American Christians, especially evangelicals. You know the shtick. Borat goes around America making anti-Semitic remarks in order to elicit a nodding anti-Semitic response. And with enough liquor and cajoling, he succeeds. In the most notorious such scene, on Da Ali G show where the character was born, Borat sings, "Throw the Jew down the well" in an Arizona bar as the local rubes join in. Sacha Baron Cohen, the creator of Borat, revealed his purpose for doing that in a rare out-of-character interview he granted Rolling Stone, in part, to counter charges that he was promoting anti-Semitism. On the face of it, this would be odd, given that Cohen is himself a Sabbath-observing Jew. His defense is that he is using Borat's anti-Semitism as a tool to expose it in others, and that his Arizona bar stunt revealed, if not anti-Semitism, then indifference to anti-Semitism, and that, he maintains, was the path to the Holocaust. Whoa, does he really believe such rubbish? Can a man that smart, Cambridge investment banker and now brilliant filmmaker, really believe that indifference to anti-Semitism and the road to the Holocaust are to be found in a country and western bar in Tucson? Of all the gin joints in all the towns and all the world. With anti-Semitism reemerging in Europe and rampant in the Islamic world, with Iran acquiring the ultimate weapon of genocide and proclaiming its intention to wipe out the world's largest Jewish community, Israel, with America and in particular its Christian evangelicals the only remaining Gentile constituency anywhere willing to defend that besieged Jewish outpost, is the American heartland really the locus of anti-Semitism? Is this the one place to go to find it? In Venezuela, Hugo Chavez says that the descendants of the same ones that crucified Christ have taken possession of all the wealth in the world. Just this month, Tehran hosted an international festival of Holocaust cartoons, featuring enough hooked noses and horns to give Goebbels a posthumous smile. Throughout the Islamic world, newspapers and television, schoolbooks and sermons are filled with the most vile anti-Semitism. Baron Cohen could easily have found what he seeks closer to home. He is, after all, from Europe, where synagogues are torched and cemeteries desecrated in a revival of anti-Semitism, not indifference to, but active, unseen since the Holocaust. Where a Jew is singled out for torture and death by French African thugs, where a leading Norwegian intellectual, Et tu, Norway, mocks God's chosen people. We laugh at this people's capriciousness and weep at its misdeeds. And calls for the destruction of Israel, the state founded on the ruins of an archaic national and warlike religion. Yet amid this gathering darkness, an alarming number of liberal Jews are seized with the notion that the real threat lurks deep in the hearts of American Protestants, most specifically Southern evangelicals. Some fear that their children are going to be converted. Others, that below the surface lies a pogrom waiting to happen. Still others, that the evangelicals will take power in Washington and enact their own Sharia law. This is all quite crazy. America is the most welcoming, religiously tolerant, philo-Semitic country in the world. No nation since Cyrus the Great's Persia has done more for the Jews, and its reward is to be exposed as latently anti-Semitic by an itinerant Jew looking for laughs, and he solemnly assures us for the path to the Holocaust? Look, it is very hard to be a Jew today, particularly in Baron Cohen's Europe, where Jew-baiting is once again becoming acceptable. But it is a sign of the disorientation of a distressed and confused people that we should find it so difficult to distinguish our friends from our enemies. The Washington Post, November 24, 2006. Judging Israel. Jews are news. It is an axiom of journalism. An indispensable axiom, too, because it is otherwise impossible to explain why the deeds and misdeeds of dot-on-the-map Israel get an absurdly disproportionate amount of news coverage around the world. If you are trying to guess how much coverage any Middle East event received, and you are permitted but one question, the best question you can ask about the event is, were there any Jews in the vicinity? The paradigmatic case is the page in the International Herald Tribune that devoted 7 of its 8 columns to the Palestinian uprising. Among the headlines, Israeli soldier shot to death. Palestinian toll rises to 96. The 8th column carried a report that 5,000 Kurds died in an Iraqi gas attack. Whatever the reason, it is a fact that the world is far more interested in what happens to Jews than to Kurds. It is perfectly legitimate, therefore, for journalists to give the former more play. But that makes it all the more incumbent to be fair in deciding how to play it. How should Israel be judged? Specifically, should Israel be judged by the moral standards of its neighborhood or by the standards of the West? The answer, unequivocally, is the standards of the West. But the issue is far more complicated than it appears. The first complication is that Although the neighborhood standard ought not to be Israel's, it cannot be ignored when judging Israel. Why? It is plain that compared with the way its neighbors treat protest, prisoners, and opposition in general, Israel is a beacon of human rights. The salient words are Hama, the town where Syria dealt with an Islamic uprising by killing perhaps 20,000 people in 2 weeks, and then paving the dead over, and Black September 1970, during which enlightened Jordan dealt with its Palestinian intifada by killing at least 2,500 Palestinians in 10 days, a toll that the Israeli intifada would need 10 years to match. Any moral judgment must take into account the alternative. Israel cannot stand alone, and if it is abandoned by its friends for not meeting Western standards of morality, it will die. What will replace it? The neighbors, Syria, Jordan, the PLO, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Ahmed Jabril, Abu Nidal, if he is still around, or some combination of these. An outcome that will induce acute nostalgia for Israel's human rights record. Any moral judgment that refuses to consider the alternative is merely irresponsible. That is why Israel's moral neighborhood is important. It is not just the neighborhood, it is the alternative, and if Israel perishes, the future. It is morally absurd, therefore, to reject Israel for failing to meet Western standards of human rights when the consequence of that rejection is to consign the region to neighbors with considerably less regard for human rights. Nevertheless, Israel cannot be judged by the moral standards of the neighborhood. It is part of the West. It bases much of its appeal to Western support on shared values, among which is a respect for human rights. The standard for Israel must be Western standards. But what exactly does Western standards mean? Here we come to complication number two. There is not a single Western standard. There are two. What we demand of Western countries at peace and what we demand of Western countries at war. It strains not just fairness but also logic to ask Israel, which has known only war for its 40 years' existence, to act like a Western country at peace. The only fair standard is this one. How have the Western democracies reacted in similar conditions of war, crisis, and insurrection? The morally relevant comparison is not with an American police force reacting to violent riots, say in downtown Detroit, though even by this standard, the standard of America's response to the urban riots of the 60s, Israel's handling of the Intifada has been measured. The relevant comparison is with Western democracies at war, to, say, the U.S. during the Civil War, the British in Mandatory Palestine, the French in Algeria. Last fall, Anthony Lewis excoriated Israel for putting down a tax revolt in the town of Beit Sa'ur. He wrote, "Suppose the people of some small American town decided to protest federal government policy by withholding their taxes. The government responded by sending in the army. Unthinkable? Of course it is in this country, but it is happening in another, Israel." Middle East scholar Clinton Bailey tried to point out just how false this analogy is. Protesting federal government policy? The West Bank is not Selma. Palestinians are not demanding service at the lunch counter. They demand a flag and an army. This is insurrection for independence. They are part of a movement whose covenant explicitly declares its mission to be the abolition of the State of Israel. Bailey tried manfully for the better analogy. It required him to posit, one, a pre-Glasnost Soviet Union, two, a communist Mexico demanding the return of occupied Mexican territory lost in the Mexican War, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Nevada, and California, and three, insurrection by former Mexicans living in these territories, demanding secession from the Union. Then imagine, Bailey continued, that the insurrectionists, supported and financed by Mexico and other communist states in Latin America, obstruct communications, attack civilians and police with stones and firebombs, kill former Mexicans holding U.S. government jobs, collaborators, and then begin a tax revolt. Now you have the correct analogy. Would the U.S., like Israel, then send in the army? Of course. But even this analogy falls flat because it is simply impossible to imagine an America in a position of conflict and vulnerability analogous to Israel's. America's condition is so radically different, so far from the brink. Yet when Western countries have been in conditions approximating Israel's, when they have faced comparable rebellions, they have acted not very differently. We do not even have to go back to Lincoln's Civil War, suspension of habeas corpus, let alone Sherman's march through Georgia. Consider that during the last Palestinian Intifada, the Arab Revolt of 1936 to 1939, the British were in charge of Palestine. They put down the revolt without mercy, without qualms, writes Middle East scholar Fawad Ajami. Entire villages were razed. More than 3,000 Palestinians were killed. In 1939 alone, the British hanged 109. Israel has no death penalty. French conduct during the Algerian War was noted for its indiscriminate violence and systematic use of torture. In comparison, Israeli behavior has been positively restrained, and yet Israel faces a far greater threat. All the Algerians wanted, after all, was independence. They were not threatening the extinction of France. If Israel had the same assurance as France that its existence was in no way threatened by its enemies, the whole Arab-Israeli conflict could have been resolved decades ago. Or consider more contemporary democracies. A year ago, when rioting broke out in Venezuela over government-imposed price increases, more than 300 were killed in less than 1 week. In 1984, the Army of Democratic India attacked rebellious Sikhs in the Golden Temple, killing 300 in 1 day. And yet these democracies were not remotely as threatened as Israel. Venezuela was threatened with disorder, India at worst with secession. The Sikhs have never pledged themselves to throw India into the sea. Israel, opined The Economist, cannot in fairness test itself against a standard set by China and Algeria while still claiming to be part of the West. This argument, heard all the time, is a phony. Israel asks to be judged by the standard not of China and Algeria, but of Britain and France, of Venezuela and India. By that standard, the standard of democracies facing similar disorders, Israel's behavior has been measured and restrained. Yet Israel has been treated as if this were not true. The thrust of the reporting, and in particular the commentary, is that Israel has failed dismally to meet Western standards, that it has been particularly barbaric in its treatment of the Palestinian uprising. No other country is repeatedly subjected to Nazi analogies. In no other country is the death or deportation of a single rioter the subject, as it was for the first year of the Intifada, before it became a media bore, of front-page news, of emergency security council meetings, of full-page ads in the New York Times, of pained editorials about Israel's lost soul, etc., etc. Why is that so? Why is it that of Israel a standard of behavior is demanded that is not just higher than its neighbors, not just equal to that of the West, but in fact far higher than that of any Western country in similar circumstances? Why the double standard? For most, the double standard is unconscious. Critics simply assume it appropriate to compare Israel with a secure and peaceful America. They ignore the fact that there are two kinds of Western standards and that fairness dictates subjecting Israel to the standard of a Western country at war. But other critics openly demand higher behavior from the Jewish state than from other states. Why? Jews, it is said, have a long history of oppression. They thus have a special vocation to avoid oppressing others. This dictates a higher standard in dealing with others. Note that this reasoning is applied only to Jews. When other people suffer, Vietnamese, Algerians, Palestinians, the French Maquis, they are usually allowed a grace period during which they are judged by a somewhat lower standard. The victims are, rightly or wrongly, in my view, wrongly, morally indulged. A kind of moral affirmative action applies. We are asked to understand the former victims' barbarities because of how they themselves suffered. There has, for example, been little attention to and less commentary on the 150 Palestinians lynched by other Palestinians during the Intifada. How many know that this year as many Palestinians have died at the hands of Palestinians as at the hands of Israelis? With Jews, that kind of reasoning is reversed. Jewish suffering does not entitle them to more leeway in trying to prevent a repetition of their tragedy, but to less. Their suffering requires them, uniquely among the world's sufferers, to bend over backward in dealing with their enemies. Sometimes it seems as if Jews are entitled to protection and equal moral consideration only insofar as they remain victims. Oriana Fallaci once said plaintively to Ariel Sharon, "You are no more the nation of the great dream, the country for which we cried." Indeed, not. In establishing a Jewish state, the Jewish people made a collective decision no longer to be cried for. They chose to become actors in history and not its objects. Historical actors commit misdeeds and should be judged like all nation-states when they commit them. It is perverse to argue that because this particular nation-state is made up of people who have suffered the greatest crime in modern history, they, more than any other people on earth, have a special obligation to be delicate with those who would bring down on them yet another national catastrophe. That is a double standard. What does double standard mean? To call it a higher standard is simply a euphemism. That makes it sound like a compliment. In fact, it is a weapon. If I hold you to a higher standard of morality than others, I am saying that I am prepared to denounce you for things I would never denounce anyone else for. If I were to make this kind of judgment about people of color, say if I demanded that blacks meet a higher standard in their dealings with others, that would be called racism. Let's invent an example. Imagine a journalistic series on cleanliness in neighborhoods. A city newspaper studies a white neighborhood and a black neighborhood and finds that while both are messy, the black neighborhood is cleaner. But week in, week out, the paper runs front-page stories comparing the garbage and graffiti in the black neighborhood to the pristine loveliness of Switzerland, then chips in an op-ed piece deploring, more in sadness than in anger, the irony that blacks, who for so long had degradation imposed on them, should now impose degradation on themselves. Something is wrong here. To denounce blacks for misdemeanors that we overlook in whites, that is a double standard. It is not a compliment. It is racism. The conscious deployment of a double standard directed at the Jewish state, and at no other state in the world, the willingness systematically to condemn the Jewish state for things others are not condemned for, this is not a higher standard. It is a discriminatory standard. And discrimination against Jews has a name, too. The word for it is anti-Semitism. Time, February 26, 1990. Essay, Zionism and the Fate of the Jews. 1. A Small Nation. Milan Kundera once defined a small nation as one whose very existence may be put in question at any moment. A small nation can disappear, and it knows it. The United States is not a small nation, either is Japan or France. These nations may suffer defeats, they may even be occupied, but they cannot disappear. Kundera's Czechoslovakia could and once did. Pre-war Czechoslovakia is the paradigmatic small nation, a liberal democracy created in the ashes of war by a world determined to let little nations live free, threatened by the covetousness and sheer mass of a rising neighbor. Compromised fatally by a West grown weary of a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing. Left truncated and defenseless, succumbing finally to conquest. When Hitler entered Prague in March 1939, he declared, Czechoslovakia has ceased to exist. Israel, too, is a small country. This is not to say that extinction is its fate, only that it can be. Moreover, in its vulnerability to extinction, Israel is not just any small country, it is the only small country, the only country, period, whose neighbors publicly declare its very existence an affront to law, morality, and religion, and make its extinction an explicit, paramount national goal. Nor is the goal merely declarative. Iran, Libya, and Iraq conduct foreign policies designed for the killing of Israelis and the destruction of their state. They choose their allies, Hamas, Hezbollah, and develop their weapons, suicide bombs, poison gas, anthrax, nuclear missiles, accordingly. Countries as far away as Malaysia will not allow a representative of Israel on their soil or even permit the showing of Schindler's List, lest it engender sympathy for Zion. Others are more circumspect in their declarations. No longer is the destruction of Israel the unanimous goal of the Arab League, as it was for the 30 years before Camp David. Syria, for example, no longer explicitly enunciates it. Yet Syria would destroy Israel tomorrow if it had the power. Its current reticence on the subject is largely due to its post-Cold War need for the American connection. Even Egypt, first to make peace with Israel and the presumed model for peacemaking, has built a vast U.S.-equipped army that conducts military exercises, obviously designed for fighting Israel. Its huge Badr 96 exercises, for example, Egypt's largest since the 1973 war, featured simulated crossings of the Suez Canal. And even the PLO, which was forced into ostensible recognition of Israel in the Oslo Agreements of 1993, is still ruled by a national charter that calls, in at least 14 places, for Israel's eradication. The fact that after 5 years and four specific promises to amend the charter, it remains unamended is a sign of how deeply engraved the dream of eradicating Israel remains in the Arab consciousness. 2. The stakes. The contemplation of Israel's disappearance is very difficult for this generation. For 50 years, Israel has been a fixture. Most people cannot remember living in a world without Israel. Nonetheless, this feeling of permanence has more than once been rudely interrupted. During the first few days of the Yom Kippur War, when it seemed as if Israel might be overrun, or those few weeks in May and early June 1967, when Nasser blockaded the Straits of Tehran and marched 100,000 troops into Sinai to drive the Jews into the sea. Yet Israel's stunning victory in 1967, its superiority in conventional weaponry, its success in every war in which its existence was at stake, has bred complacency. Some ridicule the very idea of Israel's impermanence. Israel, wrote one diaspora intellectual, is fundamentally indestructible. Yitzhak Rabin knew this. The Arab leaders on Mount Herzl at Rabin's funeral knew this. Only the land-grabbing, trigger-happy saints of the right do not know this. They are animated by the imagination of catastrophe, by the thrill of attending the end. Thrill was not exactly the feeling Israelis had when, during the Gulf War, they entered sealed rooms and donned gas masks to protect themselves from mass death, in a war in which Israel was not even engaged. The feeling was fear, dread, helplessness, old existential Jewish feelings that post-Zionist fashion today deems anachronistic, if not reactionary. But wish does not overthrow reality. The Gulf War reminded even the most wishful that in an age of nerve gas, missiles, and nukes, an age in which no country is completely safe from weapons of mass destruction, Israel, with its compact population and tiny area, is particularly vulnerable to extinction. Israel is not on the edge. It is not on the brink. This is not 48 or 67 or 73. But Israel is a small country. It can disappear, and it knows it. It may seem odd to begin an examination of the meaning of Israel and the future of the Jews by contemplating the end, but it does concentrate the mind. And it underscores the stakes. The stakes could not be higher. It is my contention that on Israel, on its existence and survival, hangs the very existence and survival of the Jewish people. Or to put the thesis in the negative, that the end of Israel means the end of the Jewish people. They survived destruction and exile at the hands of Babylon in 586 BC. They survived destruction and exile at the hands of Rome in AD 70, and finally in AD 135. They cannot survive another destruction and exile. The Third Commonwealth, modern Israel, born just 50 years ago, is the last. The return to Zion is now the principal drama of Jewish history. What began as an experiment has become the very heart of the Jewish people. Its cultural, spiritual, and psychological center, soon to become its demographic center as well. Israel is the hinge. Upon it rest the hopes, the only hope, for Jewish continuity and survival. 3. The Dying Diaspora. In 1950, there were 5 million Jews in the United States. In 1990, the number was a slightly higher 5.5 million. In the intervening decades, overall U.S. population rose 65%. The Jews essentially tread water. In fact, in the last half century, Jews have shrunk from 3% to 2% of the American population. And now they are headed for not just relative but absolute decline. What sustained the Jewish population at its current level was first the post-war baby boom, then the influx of 400,000 Jews, mostly from the Soviet Union. Well, the baby boom is over, and Russian immigration is drying up. There are only so many Jews where they came from. Take away these historical anomalies, and the American Jewish population would be smaller today than yesterday. In fact, it is now headed for catastrophic decline. Stephen Boehm, director of Jewish communal affairs at the American Jewish Committee, flatly predicts that in 20 years, the Jewish population will be down to 4 million, a loss of nearly 30%. In 20 years, projecting just a few decades further yields an even more chilling future. How does a community decimate itself in the benign conditions of the United States? Easy, low fertility and endemic intermarriage. The fertility rate among American Jews is 1.6 children per woman. The replacement rate, the rate required for the population to remain constant, is 2.1. The current rate is thus 20% below what is needed for zero growth. Thus, fertility rates alone would cause a 20% decline in every generation. In three generations, the population would be cut in half. The low birth rate does not stem from some peculiar aversion of Jewish women to children. It is merely a striking case of the well-known and universal phenomenon of birth rates declining with rising education and socioeconomic class. Educated, successful working women tend to marry late and have fewer babies. And now a second factor, intermarriage. In the United States today, more Jews marry Christians than marry Jews. The intermarriage rate is 52%. A more conservative calculation yields 47%. The demographic effect is basically the same. In 1970, the rate was 8%. Most important for Jewish continuity, however, is the ultimate identity of the children born to these marriages. Only about 1 in 4 is raised Jewish. Thus, 2/3 of Jewish marriages are producing children, 3/4 of whom are lost to the Jewish people. Intermarriage rates alone would cause a 25% decline in population in every generation. Math available upon request. In 2 generations, half the Jews would disappear. Now, combine the effects of fertility and intermarriage and make the overly optimistic assumption that every child raised Jewish will grow up to retain his Jewish identity, that is, a zero dropout rate. You can start with 100 American Jews, you end up with 60. In 1 generation, more than 1/3 have disappeared. In just 2 generations, 2 out of every 3 will vanish. One can reach this same conclusion by a different route, bypassing the intermarriage rates entirely. A Los Angeles Times poll of American Jews conducted in March 1998 asked a simple question: are you raising your children as Jews? Only 70% said yes. A population in which the biological replacement rate is 80% and the cultural replacement rate is 70% is headed for extinction. By this calculation, every 100 Jews are raising 56 Jewish children. In just 2 generations, 7 out of every 10 Jews will vanish. The demographic trends in the rest of the diaspora are equally unencouraging. In Western Europe, fertility and intermarriage rates mirror those of the United States. Take Britain. Over the last generation, British Jewry has acted as a kind of controlled experiment. A diaspora community living in an open society, but unlike that in the United States, not artificially sustained by immigration. What happened? Over the last quarter century, the number of British Jews declined by over 25%. Over the same interval, France's Jewish population declined only slightly. The reason for this relative stability, however, is a one-time factor, the influx of North African Jewry. That influx is over. In France today, only a minority of Jews between the ages of 20 and 44 live in a conventional family with 2 Jewish parents. France, too, will go the way of the rest. The dissolution of European Jewry, observes Bernard Wasserstein in Vanishing Diaspora, The Jews in Europe Since 1945, is not situated at some point in the hypothetical future. The process is taking place before our eyes and is already far advanced. Under present trends, the number of Jews in Europe by the year 2000 would then be not much more than 1 million, the lowest figure since the last Middle Ages. In 1900, there were 8 million. The story elsewhere is even more dispiriting. The rest of what was once the diaspora is now either a museum or a graveyard. Eastern Europe has been effectively emptied of its Jews. In 1939, Poland had 3.2 million Jews. Today, it is home to 3,500. The story is much the same in the other capitals of Eastern Europe. The Islamic world, cradle to the great Sephardic Jewish tradition, and home to one-third of world Jewry 3 centuries ago, is now practically Judenrein. Not a single country in the Islamic world is home to more than 20,000 Jews. After Turkey with 19,000 and Iran with 14,000, the country with the largest Jewish community in the entire Islamic world is Morocco, with 6,100. There are more Jews in Omaha, Nebraska. These communities do not figure in projections. There is nothing to project. They are fit subjects, not for counting, but for remembering. Their very sound has vanished. Yiddish and Ladino, the distinctive languages of the European and Sephardic diasporas, like the communities that invented them, are nearly extinct. 4. The dynamics of assimilation. Is it not risky to assume that current trends will continue? No. Nothing will revive the Jewish communities of Eastern Europe and the Islamic world, and nothing will stop the rapid decline by assimilation of Western Jewry. On the contrary, projecting current trends, assuming, as I have done, that rates remain constant, is rather conservative. It is risky to assume that assimilation will not accelerate. There is nothing on the horizon to reverse the integration of Jews into Western culture. The attraction of Jews to the larger culture and the level of acceptance of Jews by the larger culture are historically unprecedented. If anything, the trends augur an intensification of assimilation. It stands to reason. As each generation becomes progressively more assimilated, the ties to tradition grow weaker, as measured, for example, by synagogue attendance and number of children receiving some kind of Jewish education. This dilution of identity, in turn, leads to a greater tendency to intermarriage and assimilation. Why not? What, after all, are they giving up? The circle is complete and self-reinforcing. Consider two cultural artifacts. With the birth of television a half century ago, Jewish life in America was represented by the Goldbergs, urban Jews, decidedly ethnic, heavily accented, socially distinct. 40 years later, the Goldbergs begat Seinfeld, the most popular entertainment in America today. The Seinfeld character is nominally Jewish. He might cite his Jewish identity on occasion without apology or self-consciousness, but even more important, without consequence. It has not the slightest influence on any aspect of his life. Assimilation of this sort is not entirely unprecedented. In some ways, it parallels the pattern in Western Europe after the emancipation of the Jews in the late 18th and 19th centuries. The French Revolution marks the turning point in the granting of civil rights to Jews. As they began to emerge from the ghetto, at first they found resistance to their integration and advancement. They were still excluded from the professions, higher education, and much of society. But as these barriers began gradually to erode and Jews advanced socially, Jews began a remarkable embrace of European culture and, for many, Christianity. In A History of Zionism, Walter LeCour notes the view of Gabriel Reiser, an eloquent and courageous mid-19th century advocate of emancipation, that a Jew who preferred the non-existent state and nation of Israel to Germany should be put under police protection, not because he was dangerous, but because he was obviously insane. Moses Mendelssohn, 1729-1786, was a harbinger. Cultured, cosmopolitan, though firmly Jewish, he was the quintessence of early emancipation. Yet his story became emblematic of the rapid historical progression from emancipation to assimilation. 4 of his 6 children and 8 of his 9 grandchildren were baptized. In that more religious, more Christian age, assimilation took the form of baptism, what Heinrich Heine called the admission ticket to European society. In the far more secular late 20th century, assimilation merely means giving up the quaint name, the rituals, and the other accoutrements and identifiers of one's Jewish past. Assimilation today is totally passive. Indeed, apart from the trip to the county courthouse to transform, say, Schmattes by Ralph Lifschitz into Polo by Ralph Lauren, it is marked by an absence of actions rather than the active embrace of some other faith. Unlike Mendelssohn's children, Seinfeld required no baptism. We now know, of course, that in Europe, emancipation through assimilation proved a cruel hoax. The rise of anti-Semitism, particularly late 19th century racial anti-Semitism culminating in Nazism, disabused Jews of the notion that assimilation provided escape from the liabilities and dangers of being Jewish. The saga of the family of Madeleine Albright is emblematic. Of her four Jewish grandparents, highly assimilated, with children some of whom actually converted and erased their Jewish past, three went to their deaths in Nazi concentration camps as Jews. Nonetheless, the American context is different. There is no American history of anti-Semitism remotely resembling Europe's. The American tradition of tolerance goes back 200 years to the very founding of the country. Washington's letter to the synagogue in Newport pledges not tolerance. Tolerance bespeaks non-persecution bestowed as a favor by the dominant upon the deviant, but equality. It finds no parallel in the history of Europe. In such a country, assimilation seems a reasonable solution to one's Jewish problem. One could do worse than merge one's destiny with that of a great and humane nation dedicated to the proposition of human dignity and equality. Nonetheless, while assimilation may be a solution for individual Jews, it clearly is a disaster for Jews as a collective with a memory, a language, a tradition, a liturgy, a history, a faith, a patrimony that will all perish as a result. Whatever value one might assign to assimilation, one cannot deny its reality. The trends, demographic and cultural, are stark. Not just in the long-lost outlands of the diaspora, not just in its erstwhile European center, but even in its new American heartland, the future will be one of diminution, decline, and virtual disappearance. This will not occur overnight, but it will occur soon, in but two or three generations, a time not much further removed from ours today than the founding of Israel 50 years ago. 5. Israeli exceptionalism. Israel is different. In Israel, the great temptation of modernity, assimilation, simply does not exist. Israel is the very embodiment of Jewish continuity. It is the only nation on earth that inhabits the same land, bears the same name, speaks the same language, and worships the same God that it did 3,000 years ago. You dig the soil, and you find pottery from Davidic times, coins from Bar Kokhba, and 2,000-year-old scrolls written in a script remarkably like the one that today advertises ice cream at the corner candy store. Because most Israelis are secular, however, some ultra-religious Jews dispute Israel's claim to carry on an authentically Jewish history. So do some secular Jews. A French critic, sociologist Georges Friedman, once called Israelis Hebrew-speaking Gentiles. In fact, there was once a fashion among a group of militantly secular Israeli intellectuals to call themselves Canaanites, that is, people rooted in the land but entirely denying the religious tradition from which they came. Well, then, call these people what you will. Jews, after all, is a relatively recent name for this people. They started out as Hebrews, then became Israelites. Jew, derived from the Kingdom of Judah, one of the two successor states to the Davidic and Solomonic Kingdom of Israel, is the post-exilic term for Israelite. It is a latecomer to history. What to call the Israeli who does not observe the dietary laws, has no use for the synagogue, and regards the Sabbath as the day for a drive to the beach? A fair description, by the way, of most of the prime ministers of Israel? It does not matter. Plant a Jewish people in a country that comes to a standstill on Yom Kippur, speaks the language of the Bible, moves to the rhythms of the Hebrew lunar calendar, builds cities with the stones of its ancestors, produces Hebrew poetry and literature, Jewish scholarship, and learning unmatched anywhere in the world, and you have continuity. Israelis could use a new name. Perhaps we will one day relegate the word Jew to the 2,000-year exilic experience and once again call these people Hebrews. The term has a nice historical echo, being the name by which Joseph and Jonah answered the question, "Who are you?" In the cultural milieu of modern Israel, assimilation is hardly the problem. Of course Israelis eat McDonald's and watch Dallas reruns, but so do Russians and Chinese and Danes. To say that there are heavy Western, read American, influences on Israeli culture is to say nothing more than that Israel is as subject to the pressures of globalization as any other country. But that hardly denies its cultural distinctiveness, a fact testified to by the great difficulty immigrants have in adapting to Israel. In the Israeli context, assimilation means the reattachment of Russian and Romanian, Uzbeki and Iraqi, Algerian and Argentinian Jews to a distinctively Hebraic culture. It means the exact opposite of what it means in the diaspora. It means giving up alien languages, customs, and traditions. It means giving up Christmas and Easter for Hanukkah and Passover. It means giving up ancestral memories of the steppes and the pampas and the savannas of the world for Galilean hills and Jerusalem stone and Dead Sea desolation. That is what these new Israelis learn. That is what is transmitted to their children. That is why their survival as Jews is secure. Does anyone doubt that the near million Soviet immigrants to Israel would have been largely lost to the Jewish people had they remained in Russia, and that now they will not be lost? Some object to the idea of Israel as carrier of Jewish continuity because of the myriad splits and fractures among Israelis. Orthodox versus secular, Ashkenazi versus Sephardi, Russian versus Sabra, and so on. Israel is now engaged in bitter debates over the legitimacy of conservative and reform Judaism and the encroachment of orthodoxy upon the civic and social life of the country. So, what's new? Israel is simply recapitulating the Jewish norm. There are equally serious divisions in the diaspora, as there were within the last Jewish commonwealth. Before the ascendancy of the Pharisees and the emergence of rabbinic orthodoxy after the fall of the Second Temple, writes Harvard Near East scholar Frank Cross, Judaism was more complex and variegated than we had supposed. The Dead Sea Scrolls, explains Herschel Shanks, emphasize a hitherto unappreciated variety in Judaism of the late Second Temple period, so much so that scholars often speak not simply of Judaism, but of Judaisms. The Second Commonwealth was a riot of Jewish sectarianism. Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, apocalyptics of every stripe, sects now lost to history, to say nothing of the early Christians. Those concerned about the secular religious tensions in Israel might contemplate the centuries-long struggle between Hellenizers and traditionalists during the Second Commonwealth. The Maccabean Revolt of 167 to 164 BC, now celebrated as Hanukkah, was, among other things, a religious civil war among Jews. Yes, it is unlikely that Israel will produce a single Jewish identity, but that is unnecessary. The relative monolith of rabbinic Judaism in the Middle Ages is the exception. Fracture and division are facts of life during the modern era, as during the First and Second Commonwealths. Indeed, during the period of the First Temple, the people of Israel were actually split into two often warring states. The current divisions within Israel pale in comparison. Whatever identity or identities are ultimately adopted by Israelis, the fact remains that for them, the central problem of diaspora Jewry, suicide by assimilation, simply does not exist. Blessed with this security of identity, Israel is growing. As a result, Israel is not just the cultural center of the Jewish world, it is rapidly becoming its demographic center as well. The relatively high birth rate yields a natural increase in population. At a steady net rate of immigration, nearly a million since the late 1980s, and Israel's numbers rise inexorably even as the diaspora declines. Within a decade, Israel will pass the United States as the most populous Jewish community on the globe. Within our lifetime, a majority of the world's Jews will be living in Israel. That has not happened since well before Christ. A century ago, Europe was the center of Jewish life. More than 80% of world Jewry lived there. The Second World War destroyed European Jewry and dispersed the survivors to the New World, mainly the United States, and to Israel. Today, 80% of world Jewry lives either in the United States or in Israel. Today, we have a bipolar Jewish universe with two centers of gravity of approximately equal size. It is a transitional stage, however. One star is gradually dimming, the other brightening. Soon and inevitably, the cosmology of the Jewish people will have been transformed again, turned into a single star system with a dwindling diaspora orbiting around. It will be a return to the ancient norm. The Jewish people will be centered, not just spiritually, but physically, in their ancient homeland. 6. The end of dispersion. The consequences of this transformation are enormous. Israel's centrality is more than just a question of demography. It represents a bold and dangerous new strategy for Jewish survival. For two millennia, the Jewish people survived by means of dispersion and isolation. Following the first exile in 586 BC and the second exile in AD 70 and AD 135, Jews spread first throughout Mesopotamia and the Mediterranean basin, then to northern and eastern Europe, and eventually west to the New World, with communities in practically every corner of the earth, even unto India and China. Throughout this time, the Jewish people survived the immense pressures of persecution, massacre, and forced conversion, not just by faith and courage, but by geographic dispersion. Decimated here, they would survive there. The thousands of Jewish villages and towns spread across the face of Europe. The Islamic world and the New World provided a kind of demographic insurance. However many Jews were massacred in the First Crusade along the Rhine, however many villages were destroyed in the 1648 to 1649 pogroms in Ukraine, there were always thousands of others spread around the globe to carry on. This dispersion made for weakness and vulnerability for individual Jewish communities. Paradoxically, however, it made for endurance and strength for the Jewish people as a whole. No tyrant could amass enough power to threaten Jewish survival everywhere. Until Hitler. The Nazis managed to destroy most everything Jewish, from the Pyrenees to the gates of Stalingrad, an entire civilization 1,000 years old. There were 9 million Jews in Europe when Hitler came to power. He killed 2/3 of them. 50 years later, the Jews have yet to recover. There were 16 million Jews in the world in 1939. Today, there are 13 million. The effect of the Holocaust was not just demographic, however. It was psychological, indeed, ideological as well. It demonstrated once and for all the catastrophic danger of powerlessness. The solution was self-defense, and that meant a demographic reconcentration in a place endowed with sovereignty, statehood, and arms. Before World War II, there was great debate in the Jewish world over Zionism. Reform Judaism, for example, was for decades anti-Zionist. The Holocaust resolved that debate. Except for those at the extremes, the ultra-Orthodox right and far left, Zionism became the accepted solution to Jewish powerlessness and vulnerability. Amid the ruins, Jews made a collective decision that their future lay in self-defense and territoriality, in the ingathering of the exiles to a place where they could finally acquire the means to defend themselves. It was the right decision, the only possible decision. But oh, so perilous. What a choice of place to make one's final stand, a dot on the map, a tiny patch of near desert, a thin ribbon of Jewish habitation behind the flimsiest of natural barriers, which the world demands that Israel relinquish. One determined tank thrust can tear it in half. One small battery of nuclear-tipped Scuds can obliterate it entirely. To destroy the Jewish people, Hitler needed to conquer the world. All that is needed today is to conquer a territory smaller than Vermont. The terrible irony is that in solving the problem of powerlessness, the Jews have necessarily put all their eggs in one basket, a small basket hard by the waters of the Mediterranean. And on its fate hinges everything Jewish.